Erythalia might be.
She went to the market today, said Lilia. I wanted to go, but Auntie Rona said I couldn't.
Ah, well, I have a bit of a problem and need some help, Highness. Would you please go and ask Countess Rona to come to me?
I don't have to do that. I'm a princess.
Passavalles took a long breath.
No, you don't. You're right, he said. My apologies, princess.
He turned to the guards as they staggered up, carrying the blanket with the wounded Cither.
Put her down there, men, he told them. We'll be taking her somewhere else when we find a clean room.
Who's that?
Asked Lilia, eyes wide.
Is she dead?
No, but she's badly hurt.
He turned back to the men.
One of you go find the mistress of chambermaids, and the other go fetch brother Etan, the apothecary. Look for him in the herb garden behind the mews.
He turned back to the princess. And I promise I'll tell you that story soon. But you want me to help this poor lady, don't you? Lilia frowned, but kept staring at the indistinct figure in the blanket sling.
Suppose... Maybe I could go tell Auntie Rona for you.
The princess was clearly of two minds. But at last she tucked her hands behind her back and skipped slowly off to find her more or less nursemaid, the Countess.
Here you are. What are you doing hiding in one of the guest chambers?
I have been searching and searching,
said Rona.
You are a popular man today, Lord Chancellor. Both princesses, mother and daughter, desire your company.
She took a step into the room and stopped, eyes wide, when she saw the figure stretched on the bed.
By the black hair, what is this?
A Cither woman, found nearly dead in the Kinswood, said Passavalles.
He needed a moment before what she said sank in.
Both princesses? I know Lilia wants a story, but... what does her mother want?
What Princess Idela wants is a mystery to me, as always.
Countess Rona was the one who began the joking custom of calling Idela the widow, because she still wore black so many years after Prince John Joshua's death, despite few other signs of actually being in mourning.
But what of this poor woman here?
She has arrow wounds, several. And she lay among the trees for days. But she lives. Now you know as much as I do.
She still lives.
The Countess bent over the motionless body, seeming caught between fascination and pity.
And you are certain she is a Cither?
Look at her. What else could she be?
One of the white foxes, just as easily.
By the good gods! Are you sure it is wise to bring her into the hayholt?
There is nowhere else we could keep her alive, and safe too, if she lives. Someone tried to kill her, Countess. And no, she is not one of the white foxes. No Norn has golden skin like that. She is only paler than usual.
The Countess had a faraway look in her eyes.
I was a young girl when the Scythi came to Ernestia.
Their tents filled the fields as far as the eye could see, and the cloth was every color on the god's earth. My mother said it was like the olden days come back.
Did your mother also tell you how to keep one of them alive?
Passavalles immediately regretted his surly tone. Rona was a valuable ally, the queen's best friend, and a member of the inner council.
I'm sorry, Countess, I beg your pardon. I seem to have left my manners out in the Kinswood.
She smiled.
No need to apologize, Lord Chancellor.
I can imagine this day has tested you, and it is scarcely past noon. But what did you want with me? I am not much use as a healer or bedside nurse. Did you send for Lady Thilia?
I am here, my lord, I am here.
Brother Etan, his youthful face red and shiny with sweat, staggered through the doorway.
I am sorry it took me so long. I had to run back to my room for my things.
He quickly examined the woman on the bed.
Goodness, the guard was right. A Sither.
She has 3 bad wounds. The arrowheads are still in them, Passivali said. And she has been exposed in the forest for several days. Oh, and Lady Thalia is gone to the market. Can you do anything for this poor creature, brother?
The monk mopped his face with the sleeve of his robe.
I cannot answer until I see what I can see.
Passivalis pointed to the 2 chambermaids who had been waiting discreetly in the corner of the room since they had finished preparing the sickbed.
For now, these good women will help you to nurse her brother. If she wakes or tries to talk, please send one of them for me immediately, no matter the time of day or night. The victim herself may be the only one who can help us unpick this crime, because make no mistake, this was no accident. Whoever shot her intended murder.
But why? Asked the Countess. And why is she here? We have not seen the city inside our walls for years.
And we would not have this time, had a poacher not stumbled onto her where she lay, half covered by forest leaves, said Passivalis. Brother Ethan, I leave you to your work. Remember, if she wakes or speaks, send for me with all haste.
Of course, Lord Chancellor.
Countess Rona walked with him down the long hall at the Royal Gallery.
She was dressed for riding, the Countess said at last.
Yes, she was. I half suspect she is a messenger from one of the king's and queen's friends among the fair folk. That is one of the reasons I am so desperate to be there if she speaks. It has been so long, and the city have been so silent. King Simon and Queen Miriamel would never forgive me if I let this messenger die.
The Countess took his arm. She was the wife of Count Niall of Nadglace, an important noble. She had a fine wit and a keen observer's eye, and she and Passivalis agreed on court matters far more often than they did not.
You take too much upon yourself, my lord, she told him. You have done all you can.
But that is the problem with royalty, he replied. Although I hasten to say that our monarchs are different than most. But still, they do not easily relinquish responsibility. Once disappointed, they will seldom bestow it again in the same place.
Countess Rona laughed.
As I said, you take too much upon yourself. But I still do not know why you asked me to come to you. Clearly it was not because of my skills as a healer.
Ah, of course, I'd nearly forgotten. This morning you said you were going to send a message to your husband with the post rider. Is your noble lord, the Count, still at Ernisadak?
He will not leave before Elysia Mansa is celebrated here,
she smiled sadly.
I miss him.
Of course. I wonder if your messenger would also carry another message, one that your husband might discreetly deliver for me.
There you are, Lord Passivalis.
He turned to see Princess Edela and 2 of her ladies moving toward them along the gallery, having likely just come from the chapel. Passivalis felt a stab of irritation. Prince John Joshua's widow was a comely young woman who had made plain her desire for his attention, although he suspected that was mostly a matter of court politics. It flattered his vanity, but it definitely made his life more difficult.
Your Highness, ladies, he said, bowing, you honor me.
Oh, good day, Countess, said Edela with a smile for Rona. I trust Lilia hasn't given you too much trouble today. Where is she?
Only Passivalis noticed the small hitch before the Countess answered.
She's lying down, Princess. She tired herself out this morning trying to convince her pony to wear a hat. Oh, the little dear.
The princess, who would never be queen, turned back to Passivalis.
I have something most important to discuss with you, Lord Steward, and yet it seems you are avoiding me. Am I so frightful that you flee me like an ogre out of a nursery tale?
Rona took that as a hint that she should find other things to do. She gave Passavalles a look of commiseration as she took her leave. He hid his annoyance behind a smile. This day of all days.
Never, princess. But less pleasant duties have been playing the tune all day, and I have been forced to dance to their measure.
And what could be of such importance, Lord Chancellor?
There was no question where little Lilia had learned to pout when denied anything. But Passavalles did not want to explain about the Scyther woman. Idela would insist on being involved, and Passavalles wanted to keep control of the situation. He would tell her later.
Nothing of great weight, Highness.
He took a breath, doing his best to push his worries from his mind. He had set everything in place, and for the moment could do nothing more. Now it was up to the Scyther to live or die.
How can I help you?
It is this library of Master Tiamak's. Well, it is the King's and Queen's library, I suppose. But you know what I mean. The little fellow seems to do nothing else these days.
Not at the moment, as you know, since he is with them on the journey to Elvritzhall.
Yes, but that is why I want to speak to you. Lord Tiamak seems most adamant that all the old books in the Hayhold must be found and written down and put in his library.
She shook her head.
All of them.
I am sure that he does not mean to take your own books, my lady.
Idela was known to spend much of her time reading the Book of the Aiden, or at least memorizing appropriate phrases that she could use to point up the failings of others.
It is the rare books, princess, the old ones, that Tiamak is so anxious to protect.
The longer the conversation lasted, the more he was feeling the tug of other duties. Idela, who was used to being waited on and cosseted, was clearly puzzled by his distraction.
Yes, and that's just it,
she said.
My John Joshua had many books, as you know. So many books. Sometimes I despaired of his attention. Even when Morgan came, the midwife could scarcely get him to lift his nose from one of them long enough to leave the room.
Your husband would have been a great scholar, Highness. Was a great scholar even in his short time. He had a rare gift.
Which was true. But he doubted Adela's ambitions for John Joshua had tended in that direction.
There is a collection of books that Tiamak has not seen. I would not even open them myself. Only the good Lord knows what horrors are in them, what ancient blasphemies. But they look very old to me. Some are only rolls of parchment, tied with string. I wish you would come by and look at them. If they belong in this library he and the King and Queen are building, the Rannerman is welcome to them.
I beg your pardon, lady, but why me? Surely Master Tiamak should be the judge of what belongs in the library.
Oh, but that little man is so greedy. I do not trust him to take only those that are truly old and valuable. And I do not want to lose my husband's possessions. They are all I have left.
Passavalles knew that what she really wanted was to have him to herself for a while, out of the public eye, and to draw him deeper into her circle. Idela was not entirely satisfied being only the mother of the heir, and was an active participant in the Hayholt's incessant contests of power and influence. But was that all? She had certainly pursued him for much of the last year, seeking him out, asking his opinion. Passavalles was beginning to wonder whether she had some deeper interest in him. She was not an astonishing beauty, but she was certainly comely, with large eyes and a fine straight nose much like her father Osric's. A man seeking to improve his position could do worse than a dalliance with the prince's widow. As long as that man could keep her sweet, he reminded himself. That was a less certain proposition. Her power depended on something that could not be undone, so she was immune to most forms of persuasion. In any case, it was a knotty problem, and not one Passivalis wished to spend time on now. He took the princess's hand and kissed it.
You do me too much credit, Highness. I'm ignorant of most such matters of scholarship. My schooling was more the rough-and-tumble sort one gets in a backwater court like Metessa. But I will put my mind to your problem and come to you with a solution very soon. Will you give me your leave to resume my less interesting duties?
And he smiled, hoping it would serve as a reassurance, no matter what she truly planned.
Of course, good Passivalis, you are the best of men. Go and do what you must do. I know that the king and queen must have left you a dreadful burden to carry in Eolair's absence.
And you are a significant part of that burden, lady. Or might become that, if I do not deal with you carefully. You are too kind, princess.
He made a bow, then left her. Behind him he heard Adela and her ladies giggling softly among themselves, like fairy music on the wind.
10. Hymns of the Lightless. Nobody who lived in Nakiga could be completely surprised to find soldiers at their door, but Vieki had not expected a troop of the feared Hamaka Wormslayer guards to arrive at his house in the middle hours of the night to demand that he accompany them. Faceless in their helmets, stern and utterly formal in their speech, the soldiers made no threats, but it was clear that he had no choice except to go with them. Vieki knew all too well that such invitations were generally the formal precursor to an execution. Despite his overwhelming shock, he still could not help wondering why, if he had fallen from her grace so completely, the mother of all had given him an audience and new orders just a few days earlier. Could this arrest be some private scheme of Akanabi's instead, using the queen's authority to remove him? If so, it seemed to be a new tactic. Ordinarily, the Lord of Song's enemies simply disappeared, or succumbed to sudden and mysterious ailments. Still, the guard chieftain had a summons that bore the queen's seal, which meant Vieki could only go with them, and tried to prepare himself for whatever might follow. Vieki's secretary, Yamon, was suspiciously absent from the household, so he directed his second cleric to ask the Hamaka guards to wait a short time for the dignity of his office. He bade his servants dress him in his magisterial robes, his great outer tunic, his sashes and belts, and did his best to stand unmoving as they did so, keeping limbs, face, and breathing respectably calm.
"Where am I being taken?"
Vieki asked, as his ornamented collar was tied in place.
"That is not for me to say," the Wormslayer chieftain replied. "Only that you are to make haste to come with us, High Magister."
At that moment his wife burst into the room, startling one of Vieki's servants into dropping the Magister's ceremonial mattock. As the tool clattered on the stones, the Wormslayers calmly leveled their spears at her.
"What happens here?"
she demanded. Despite the dishevelment of her nightwear, Kimabu eyed the Hamaka guards with contempt. Vieki noticed that she also darted a glance at his bed, no doubt to see if Tsoja had been with him.
"Why do these people trouble us, husband?"
"I truly do not know, my lady wife. But it is a lawful summons in the queen's name. We will trust to the wisdom of our mother that all will be resolved as it should be. I have done nothing wrong.
He looked at the empty features of the chieftain.
Is that not correct?
The leader stared forward, unblinking.
It is not for me to say, High Magister. Ah, yes, so you mentioned.
The Eki snapped his fingers, and his servant stepped forward to help him with the last of his clothing, the heavy overmantle.
How should I call you, officer? Do you have a name? I am a chieftain of the Silent Court of the Hamaka clan, the officer said. That is all you need to know. Such stiffness, such rote prosecution of duty, thought Fieki.
He wondered if the chieftain might be a half-blood, like his daughter Nezeru. They were common these days, especially in the ranks of the sacrifices and clan guards. How many of the worm slayers here on his doorstep were the fruits of such couplings? They seemed to make up most of the soldiery these days. But were they, as his master Yarike had once hoped, truly Hikadeya, through and through? Or were they merely crude imitations, attack dogs dressed up in the finery of the garden?
What does it matter?
He asked himself with a touch of dark amusement.
If they are only here to lead me to execution, even a trained hound could do that. Very well, chieftain, he said. I am ready to accompany you.
As he stepped out the front door past his household guards and into the wide, silent street, his wife followed them to the doorway.
Husband, she called, do not disgrace our family. How could I, kind Lady Kemabu, he replied, with your faithful support to hearten me.
The last he saw of her, the last he might ever see of her, he could not help thinking, was her long pale shape in the doorway, ordering the servants back inside before the other denizens of the noble tier saw the family's shame. Whatever hopes Vieki might have entertained that this was merely another summons to the palace vanished quickly. Instead of climbing the great staircase to the sacred third tier and the Omiyo Hamak, his guards led him downward instead into the labyrinth of the city. They passed across the deserted New Moon Market and along the edge of the ghostly web-festooned spider groves as they made their way outward toward the edge of Nakiga, through the mist clouds thrown up by the thundering tearfall, then past the massive vertical column of Tsaita's stone. At last they reached the heart wall stair and followed it down to the level stacked below the city. Vieki had given up trying to guess where he was being taken, because each new destination he could think of seemed grimmer than the last. The first level was filled with the community temples and mass burial grounds of the lower castes, the Sojino Nigagoze, or Little Gardens of Memory, Hikadeya who were too poor or too humble to have family tombs, but too proud to see their dead thrown into fiery crevices or left on burning ash heaps in the field of the nameless, had built the shared memorial parks, each full of symbols of the lost garden, each with its single silver-faced guardian, a simple upright stone figure presiding over those places of rest as the queen herself ruled the waking world. As they passed, Vieki could not help envying the sleepers in these humble shared graves. He feared he was fated for an even less exalted resting place. But it quickly became clear to him that even the throat-burning sparks and the smoky grey winds of the Field of the Nameless would not be lowly enough for him. His guards passed the fields and continued to descend, escorting him down, level by level, into the most profound depths. He thought he had been prepared for shame and execution, but it seemed the soldiers were leading him not to the simple, swift ignominy of a disgraced noble's death, but towards something altogether more disturbing.
Is it to be the chamber of the well, then?
Vieki felt his knees go weak at the thought of that ominous place, a vast natural vault of naked stone hidden deep in the heart of the mountain. The infamous chamber contained both the well and the breathing harp, objects of terrible, legendary power. It was all he could do to stay upright. "Trust the queen," he told himself, with more than a touch of desperation. "Remember the garden. Trust the way." But the old reassuring refrain now felt as hollow as the ageless and unknowable mountain deeps that were slowly enfolding him. Lower and lower they guided him, by stairs so infrequently used that they were completely dark, and the soldiers had to hold his arms as they all inched down the steps together. Fieki felt as though he climbed down the throat of some vast, impossible beast. And it was more than just frightful imagining. With each step, the air was growing steadily warmer and thicker, and the very stones around him seemed half alive. Once, as a young acolyte, Vieki had been lowered by harness into one of Nakiga's deepest interior chasms. That throat-clutching, disorienting darkness had felt a little like this, but the smothering air here seemed to quiver to some slow, heavy pulse, a vibration he had never felt before, like the beat of a giant heart. "Remember the garden." It was all he could do, all he could afford to think. "Trust the way." The fear Vieki had been trying to suppress since the dragon-helmeted soldiers first appeared at his door eased fractionally when they reached the convergence of stairways known as the Hawk's Path. Several sets of stairs entered the wide, helical stairwell from different levels, and for the first time he could see that he was not the only well-dressed figure being escorted down the spiraling steps to the chamber of the well. Fieki could not yet recognize any of his fellow nobles because of a curious thickness to the air here, as though they all swam through brackish water. But he counted at least a dozen different escorts winding their way downward. Was it possible that so many important Hikadeia would be brought together all at once for obliteration? That seemed too reckless for a planner as careful as Akinabi. At the base of the Hawk's Path, the different groups crowded together, waiting to enter a single narrow doorway, from which light of several unusual colors played across their faces, sickly yellow, deep crimson, and cadaverous grey-blue. Vieki's guards urged him forward, and for the first time he could see that his fellow guests, or prisoners, were not only magisters like himself, but also lesser officials, dozens of clan leaders, influential clerics, and other important members of the ruling caste, both male and female. If Akinabi intended to imprison or execute them all, Vieki thought wonderingly, it would mean the destruction of nearly the entirety of Nakiga's ruling elite. Then Vieki saw that one of the others being led toward the arch by a group of Hamaka guards was High Marshal Moyari Seiyora himself. Moyari was one of the most respected nobles, leader of all the queen's armies. And though he was certainly one of Akinabi's chief rivals, he was also far too powerful to be led meekly through Nakiga as a prisoner. Fieki felt certain the marshal's soldiers would never have let him be taken against his will from the Order House of Sacrifice. But even though the marshal must have come willingly, there was a deep bleakness to the commander's expression that left Fieki uneasy. The crowd surged forward. As Vieki and the other high officials and soldiers crowded through the archway and onto a single wide staircase leading down into the chamber of the well, the heat and the sense of smothering seemed to close in on him. When he put his foot on the first step, it felt as though he stepped not simply into another chamber in Great Nakiga, but out into pure space, some absolute emptiness that could not be understood. For a moment, Vieki could not tell down from up, and he wavered in something close to blind terror until he felt someone take his arm and heard a quiet voice. "Are you well, Magister?" It was Lucaia, leader of the Harvesters, and one of Vieki's few allies among the ordinal elite.
I thank you, High Gatherer, but it is nothing, he said,
although secretly he was grateful for her presence.
A misstep, that is all.
Despite the many nobles and guards descending together, the narrow stairwell was nearly silent, but for the feather-soft rustle of their footfalls. The smothering air seemed to grow even thicker and closer, but Vieki found as he descended that with self-control he could breathe normally, if more shallowly than usual. Vieki had never entered the sacred chamber of the well in all his long life, and as he emerged from the last stairwell into the cavern, he could not help staring around in fearful fascination. Arched galleries ringed the chamber both at the bottom and higher up. But what drew his eye was the hole in the center of the cavern floor, a ragged gouge surrounded by a circular lip of carved, inlaid stones, the mouth of the well. The radiance that oozed from it seemed like something heavier than mere light. Lying close along the stony floor, while leaving the reaches above the upper galleries lost in shadow. By its dull ochre gleam, Vieki thought he could see faces gazing down from the dark openings in the walls above him, or at least, things that looked like faces. The well itself blazed like the maw of one of the mountain's flaming crevices, but its thick light seemed to come from a source even older than the mountain's internal fires. A bleak, yellowish glow that might have lit the world before even the stars first began to burn, and which made everything in the great chamber seem to lean and loom. A shape hung in the column of wavering light above it, something real as blown glass, yet insubstantial as smoke. An object Vieki could not entirely understand, or even completely see. This was the breathing harp. A sacred object brought to Nakiga from lost Kementari when the immortals had fled the sudden ruination of that great city. From some angles, the harp seemed near enough for Vieki to touch, but even a slight tilt of his head reduced it to vanishingly faint scratches on the air. Lines that were barely there at all, but with spaces between them that seemed to open onto limitless vistas, and made his eyes ache. When Vieki finally pulled his gaze away, the harp seemed to linger before him like a shadow wherever he turned. But even the well and the harp could not hold his attention for long, because like any of his people, when Vieki saw the slender, silver-masked figure sitting still and pale as a statue on her great chair of black stone, he found it nearly impossible to look at anything else.
Mother of all, give strength to your servant.
The sight of the queen brought old words of worship to his mind.
My life is yours, my body is yours, my spirit is yours. If this is an execution,
Vieki thought then,
even a wholesale destruction of the noble caste, then at least my death will be at her command.
It was a strangely reassuring idea. Dying, he would at least know that order prevailed, that the mother of the people, not Akinabi, still ruled in Nakiga. The Lord of Song was present, of course, standing to one side of the queen's throne, facing the well. Its weird pulsing light, which painted Atuku's white mourning garb with earthy yellows and strange blues, fell onto the darkness of Akinabi's hooded robes and vanished, so that the powerful singer seemed to stand in his own shadow. Only his mask of dried flesh and painted runes clearly visible. More surprising to Vieki, though, was the figure on the other side of the throne, Jijibo the Dreamer. A descendant of the queen, so rarely seen outside of the palace, as to be almost a legend in the rest of Nakiga. Otuku and Akinabi were motionless as they watched the crowd assembling. But scrawny Jijibo was in perpetual twitching motion, his fingers convulsively flexing and his wide mouth working as he muttered unendingly to himself. Vieki knew from experience that the dreamer's words seemed to leap from his thoughts to his tongue, without even the faintest consideration for propriety or courtesy, or even ordinary sense. Most of Nakiga's nobles considered Jijibo helplessly mad, a rare but not unknown affliction among the people. Because he wore mismatched garments and talked to himself aloud, though often incomprehensibly. But the dreamer had a talent for devices and plans that pleased his ancestor the queen, so he was suffered to go where he wished, and to do largely as he pleased. Vieki's order of builders in particular often had to deal with his sudden demands for this or that space or materials they had planned to use themselves. But as a relative and favorite of the mother of all, Jijibo was outshone perhaps only by mighty Lord Akenabi himself, so Vieki's order seldom had any recourse but to let the dreamer have his way. Because his vision had been blocked by so many others, it was not until Vieki reached a position in the crowd, directly facing the queen's throne, that he saw a group of figures already kneeling at the queen's feet, as though to receive honors from their monarch. But their slumped postures and bound wrists told Vieki more than he wanted to know about the nature of the reward they expected. As the last of the Nakiga nobles crowded into place behind Vieki, the lightless ones began to sing in the unknown deeps below the chamber of the well. Soft, strange cries, as alien as bitterns booming in a marsh, but also as complex as speech. Some said the lightless ones had lived in the depths even before the Hikadeya came to the mountain. Some that their ancestors had traveled from the distant garden on the 8 ships with Queen Atuku and the Kideya. But in truth, nobody could say for certain whether they were many creatures or one thing with many voices. If the queen knew the lightless full tale, she never spoke of it. As they all waited in near silence, Vieki could feel fear and tension growing in his fellow nobles, as though they were a single flock of birds that might suddenly startle and take wing. Clearly most of them were as confused as he was, frightened by the unexpected summons, by the Hamaka guards who had led them here, and the squadron's worth of battle-armored Queen's Teeth guards who stood behind Atuku's throne.
"If we are not all to be executed," Vieki thought, "then there must be grave news indeed, if the queen brings us all to the well to hear it. Are we under attack? Have the mortals come again to besiege us?"
Akenabi spread his arms, his long sleeves hanging like the wings of a bat.
"Silence for the queen," he said. "Hear the mother of all."
No one had been speaking above a whisper, but at the Lord of Song's words the room grew silent in an instant. Atuku leaned forward, her eyes glittering in the slots of her mask.
"I need you, my children."
Her words were not spoken aloud, but flew straight into the minds of all those present, like a sudden thunderclap, a crash of overwhelming fury that for a long moment turned Vieki's own thoughts into shards, splinters, powder.
"I am weak," the queen told them,
although the force of her thoughts brought tears of pain to Vieki's eyes.
"My strength has been spent in the defense of our race. The sacred sleep from which I just awakened will be my last. There is no further help for me there."
Many of the nobles around Vieki began to moan, whether in pain like his at the force of the queen's words, or in fear at what they signified. But Atuku did not pause.
"Only with the aid of all your hearts and hands can I survive the present danger," she told them. "Can we all survive?"
Several of the gathered nobles, overwhelmed by the force and terror of this message, now dropped to all fours and pressed their faces against the cavern floor, like sacrificial beasts awaiting slaughter. Chichibo the dreamer laughed and did a gleeful little loose-jointed dance beside the queen's black stone chair, as though he had never seen finer entertainment. Akinabe raised his arms and spread his gloved hands, and the observers quieted.
"Our beloved queen has fought so long and hard for us,"
the Lord of Song declared,
"both here and in the lands beyond life, that she is weary, terribly weary. So she asks me to speak for her."
He raised one arm higher and curled his fingers into a fist.
"Heed your queen. We are in peril. But before we can protect ourselves from the new dangers that threaten, we must put our house in order. There are those among us who took advantage of the queen's Ketayi Indra, traitors who try to use her long sleep for their own advantage."
He paused, and his masked face looked out blankly over the crowd of nobles and soldiers.
"Libertines! Thieves! Traitors! And now they will face justice."
A pair of tall queen's teeth stepped forward and grabbed the first kneeling figure, dragged him to his feet, and then turned him around to face the crowd of nobles. His features, though battered and bruised, were all too familiar. It was Yamon, Vieki's secretary. The magister's terror returned like a blast of icy wind. Every sense, every nerve urged him to flee, but his limbs would not respond. He could only stand and wait and watch.
"So it is to be death for me, after all," he thought. "Akinabe has found someone to inform against me. Farewell, my family. I hope the disgrace is not too great to be endured. Farewell, Nezero, my daughter and heir."
But in that moment, instead of his lawful wife, it was the face of his mortal lover, Soja, that came to him. He hoped she and their daughter would not be punished for his mistakes. One by one, the other prisoners kneeling before the queen were dragged to their feet, named, and then forced around to face the watching crowd. To Vieki's increasing confusion, almost none of them held any higher rank than Yamon. A few clerics, another magister's secretary, a sacrifice commander who had only recently been named general. The most important of them was Nijika, a host singer Vieki remembered from the days of the Northmen's siege of the mountain. Like Yamon, she had new wounds on her face and head, and had obviously suffered since being seized, but she stood expressionlessly in the grip of the queen's teeth, while the watchers murmured and stared, and the lightless ones throbbed in the deep. After she had been named and displayed to the watching crowd, Nijika and all the other prisoners were forced back onto their knees again at the foot of the queen's great stone chair.
"In these terrible times, we face dangers both from within and without," Akinabe warned. "While the people's beloved mother slept, these wretched creatures you see before you conspired to flout her will. They instigated laws and directives that went against our oldest traditions, weakening their own people and making a mockery of the very memory of our garden."
Vieki was stunned by the Lord of Song's words. Surely no one gathered here could believe that this small coterie of minor officials had instigated the idea of giving half-mortal bastards the right to join important Hikadea orders like sacrifice and song. It had taken the combined power of Marshal Moyere and Vieki's master Yarike, as well as Akinabe himself and several more of the most powerful nobles, to create such sweeping changes. Had the great singer somehow managed to convince the queen of such an obvious untruth? Or was something else going on? The first prisoner, Yamon, was now dragged on his knees right to the queen's feet. He whimpered, But when he would have turned away in shame and terror from the queen's shiny, masked face, strong hands grabbed his head and held it so he could not move. Fieki expected Akinabi to read a list of charges against the prisoner, but instead the mother of the people reached down and touched Yaman's forehead with her white-gloved hand. The hapless secretary began to quiver harder and harder, until it seemed some huge invisible predator shook him in his jaws. The guards abruptly let go, as though they had found themselves holding something hot. Yaman began screeching, broken, wordless cries, even as the chant of the lightless grew louder and the air in the cavern grew warmer and thicker. Now a strange shadow slipped across the prisoner from the place where Utuku's hand touched him, rippling slowly outward, spreading down his head and over his body like ink spilled on a blotter. Yaman's shrieks subsided into little more than whistles of escaping air. Then he abruptly dissolved into a cascade of ash or black dust. Vieki barely restrained a cry of disgust and horror. While the crowd watched in rapt, uneasy silence, the next bound figure was dragged forward to the queen, and the scene was acted out once more, and then again with each of the accused traitors. By the time the last prisoner, host singer Nejika, was dragged to Utuku's throne, she had to kneel in the drifting remains of her predecessors. Nejika did not wait for death in silence, or whimper as Yaman had done. Instead, she proclaimed in a loud, clear voice that all the gathered nobles could hear,
"Hikadei, I do not know precisely what I have done, but if my queen and my master say I am guilty, then I am guilty beyond question. Nor only this, as my last and truthful words. I love my queen more than my own life, more than the honor of my family, clan, or order. I swore when I became one of her singers that I would gladly surrender my life for her, and the manner of that surrender is of no import now. I die without regret, because it is my mother's wish."
Light from the well played across Utuku's silver mask as the queen paused, and for a moment Vieki thought she had been touched by the singer's words and might pardon her. Then the queen reached forward, but instead of touching Nejika's face, she placed her fingers on the host singer's breast, as if in blessing, and the singer threw her head back in some unknowable pain or ecstasy. The queen leaned farther forward. Her hand seemed to pass into Najika's body. The prisoner cried out, a moan of uttermost extremity like nothing Vieki had ever heard. Then the blackness swept over Nejika like wildfire, and she crumbled into a mound of dark motes, indistinguishable from those who had died before her. But as this ashy powder settled to the cavern floor and the wisps of smoke dissipated, Vieki saw that the queen held something in her hand. It was Nejika's heart, still wet, but blackened in places, as though it had been pulled from a fire.
"Here, Song Lord," Utuku's thoughts, though directed at Lord Akinabi, pierced Vieki like darts of ice. "Keep this with honor in your order house. Her circumstances may have made her traitor, but the host singer's heart remained true."
The Lord of Song accepted the burned thing from the queen, nodded in apparent gratitude, and then stepped back.
"So ends the conspiracy," he announced. "So must it always come to those who betray our queen and people."
Many of the audience in the chamber of the well now cheered and called out their thanks, praising the queen and Akinabi for preserving them from the traitors. But Vieki could not help noticing that Moyere, marshal of all sacrifices, leader of the queen's armies, was not one of those caught up in the moment. The great warrior stood with eyes downcast, his arms at his side, and Vieki realized that whatever was happening here, it was not yet over.
"Hear me now, as I speak for the queen," intoned Akinabi. "Hear now why you are all needed, why your strength and loyalty are our only defenses against destruction.
He raised his arms again, waiting for the shocked murmurs of the onlookers to fade to stillness.
Yes, destruction! You all know of Ineluki, Storm King, who fought the mortals until they destroyed him, then returned from death to fight them once more, before being destroyed forever in the War of Return. The same war that forced our queen into the healing sleep from which she has only now awakened.
As Akanabi spoke, the queen looked upward, past the well and the breathing harp, her masked face staring into the farthest heights of the chamber, where cold from above met the damp warmth from the mountain's depths, and flakes of snow had begun to swirl.
When Ineluki of the Zedaya was still a living king,
Akanabi continued,
defending the great fortress of Aswa from the ravaging Northmen, he turned to our queen for help in his struggle against the mortals. She sent him the finest hearts of the Order of Song, 5 of our eldest, wisest, most skilled singers. These 5 lords of song, Karkaraji, Suteki, Omu, Enahe, and Olorutsu, may they all be remembered as long as the garden itself, were afterward called the Red Hand. Adding their strength and knowledge to Ineluki's, they bent the walls of time and space, and sang up ancient powers and dreadful spirits. But not even the Red Hand were powerful enough to defeat the swarming Northmen and their iron weapons. In desperation, Ineluki sought for a weapon so devastating that it would scour the plague of mortals from the face of our land forever. But his summoning failed, and he was destroyed. The 5 Red Hand perished and died beside Ineluki. Aswa fell to the mortal invaders.
A cry of grief and loss went up from the crowd, as if the old and familiar story were being told for the first time. Even the lightless ones seemed to hear it with dismay, and their alien voices thrummed in counterpoint from the depths.
Thus passed the last kingdom of our kind from these lands, said Akanabi. The last that is but for our home, this mountain of Nakika. Ineluki's Zedaya kinsmen scattered to the woods and other hiding holes. We, Hikadeya, sealed ourselves behind our great gates as the tide of mortal men swept across all we had known and loved. But Ineluki, though his earthly shell had died, was not truly gone. His anger was so strong that he lingered in the places between as a spirit of helpless rage, until our queen found him again.
He bowed and made an elaborate gesture of gratitude towards silent Atuku. Most in the crowd imitated him.
Yes, he went on, louder now. Our queen risked her own precious life to search for him in those dark regions where life itself is the enemy. And when she found what remained of him, a small deathless flame of rage, she brought him to sanctuary in the endless corridors of the breathing harp. Together, our queen and Ineluki Storm King summoned back the spirits of the Red Hand as well.
We thwarted the true death for you.
The queen's thoughts were ragged, but so powerful that many of those listening cried out to hear them.
All for you. And now that death stalks me in turn.
some of the Hikadea were slack-mouthed and moaning.
"And so we prepared to strike at the mortals once more, and the war of return continued," said Akanabi. "But again, treachery overcame us. This time, those of our own race, Inaluki's own cowardly kinsmen, sided with the mortals. The turncoat House of Year Dancing led the remaining Zedeya against us. And less than half a great year ago, we were defeated at the very gates of Aswa. Inaluki Storm King, that great heart, that sacrifice for his people, was delivered to Unbeing and is forever lost to us. One of the bravest of all our kind, unmade. And when Inaluki and the Red Hand failed this time, our beloved queen was also nearly destroyed.
Some of the gathered Hikadeya cried out in fury and shook their fists in the air, as if the treacherous Zedeya were here with them in the depths of Nakiga and could be punished.
"Futility!" cried Akanabi. "Ah, such a bitter taste! There is no poison to match it. But do not underestimate our queen, who loves and protects us always. Because, in the grim aftermath of that failure, as she wandered lost in the Ketayindra, great Utuku was still searching for a way to destroy our treacherous enemies. And she found one."
The cries of anger ceased. The great chamber fell silent. Even the lightless seemed to pause and listen.
"Inaluki was gone, and most of his Red Hand, too,"
the Lord of Song continued.
"But one who had sacrificed all for us and for the queen still lived. And Utuku, the mother of all, found that fearless spirit in the lands where sleep and death meet."
Although it was Akanabi who spoke, all eyes were now on the motionless queen.
"Yes, for despite all the mortals could do,"
Akanabi declared,
"Omu, the voiceless, one of the greatest of all our kind, had not entirely perished in the Storm King's destruction. Try to imagine such devotion, Hikadeya,"
Akanabi cried.
"Already murdered once by mortals, return from death to fight again for our kind. And then murdered once more by those same cruel mortal hands. And yet still, Omu of the Red Hand would not die."
Murmurs of horrified wonder rose from the crowd.
"Full of secrets from the places between, still burning for the vengeance that has been denied us, Omu, the Whisperer, did not surrender. And even as I speak, she still clings to existence in the dreadful lands beyond life. And in this very hour, but only with your help, the queen will bring Omu back to us."
Although he was as stunned by this as the rest, Vieki was also full of doubt. Even if the bizarre tale of Omu's survival was true, what could death have taught the undead singer that it had not already shown her the first time she died? How would bringing back one of the Red Hand change the Hikadeya's fortunes when the queen and Inaluki themselves had not managed it? And why had Vieki and the rest of Nakiga's elite been brought here to the Chamber of the Well?
"We will prepare for her return,"
Akanabi announced. As he spoke, a squadron of queen's teeth appeared from one of the chamber's outer archways. Four of them carried an open ceremonial litter, with a young woman of the Hikadeya swaying inside it. She was dressed in a robe as rich as one of Utuku's own, an ornate masterpiece of patterned spin silk, and her jet hair was elaborately curled and pinned as if for a wedding. But despite her rich clothes and considerable beauty, Fieki did not recognize her. As the guards set the litter down by the edge of the well, her head wobbled. She did not seem to see anything around her, not the assembled nobles, not the breathing harp, not even the queen herself.
"She has been given Kivisha," Fieki realized. "She walks in dream. But why? Who is she? And what is happening here?" "Lend your queen the strength of your hearts," commanded Akanabi. "And today, the mother of the people will bring back one whom the mortals could not unmake for all their trying."
His voice grew softer. Fieki thought the Lord of Song mimicked regret.
"But that return is not without cost, and Ormuz's passage will not come without pain to us all. Praise loudly, loyal Marshal Moyeri, High Magister of the Order of Sacrifice, who at our queen's request gives Yah Jalamu, his own granddaughter, to be the opener of the way." "Praise Moyeri," someone shouted. "May the garden remember and bless him always." "Praise the queen," cried someone else. "Praise the mother of us all."
Fieki could feel everything the others felt, the fear and exhilaration of the queen's struggle on their behalf. But some of his doubts remained. The girl might only be one of Moyeri's several granddaughters, and part mortal at that. Fieki had heard her mother was a human slave, like his own Soja. But it seemed hard to believe that the marshal had surrendered her willingly to such a terrible fate, no matter how exalted the purpose. Moyeri was a powerful man, with all the armed might of the Order of Sacrifice at his command. Only an order from the queen herself could have made him do it.
"Respect this noble gift of the High Magister," Akanabi proclaimed. "Revere Moyere's loyalty and his granddaughter's honorable sacrifice, which will open the door for Ormuz's return to us. The queen declares that in Yah Jalamu's name, an entire new league of the Order of Sacrifice will be created. The League Set Jalamu."
A shout of approval and gratitude went up from the assembled nobles. But Moyeri still gazed steadily at the ground before him, as if the sacrifice Akinabi was praising brought him only pain. He clearly could not bear to look at his granddaughter's face, though she would not have known him in her Kivisha dream.
"Now our queen needs your silence,"
Akinabi announced, and the chamber grew quiet. Even the throbbing of the air seemed to diminish. Only the lightless ones continued as they had been, their distant song droning and echoing beneath the great chamber.
"She also needs your hearts and thoughts," said the Lord of Song. "Only with the return of great Ommu can our queen resist those who would attack and destroy us. If our people are to survive, we must bring the Whisperer back from death to help our beloved queen fight for our survival. It is time for the opening of the way."
Now Fieki heard another note join the music of the lightless, soft at first, but rising in pitch and volume, until it wound through their croaking hymn like a single bright thread in a dark-hued tapestry. It was one of Akanabi's order of singers, kneeling beside Yah Jalamu's litter. More singers joined, and it sounded as if the icy mountain winds had all been given tongue, each syllable so sharp and cold that they seemed to pierce the bodies of all those listening, and turn their inner organs to frost.
"Why perform such a ritual in front of us all?" Fieki wondered. "The Order of Song
never display their powers this way. Why now?
The answer came when he felt something touching his thoughts, a probing pressure that soon became an altogether more commanding intrusion. It was the Queen, he realized, taking control of his mind and the minds of his fellow nobles, weaving them into one thing, using their strength and her own together to pierce the veils that bounded life. The Magister resisted from pure reflex, but only for a moment. His strength was nothing against the Queen's. Within moments, he and the others were no longer individual Hikadeia, but were being shaped into a single tool in Atuku's matchless grip. He could feel something of the Queen's emotions, her fixed determination, and even her chilly satisfaction as she caught them all up and wove them together.
"Do not resist, the mother of all,"
Akanabe declared as if he had sensed Vieki's unwillingness.
"Now, silence! Silence for the word of opening!"
The song abruptly grew louder, more painful to the ear, the words harsh as hammer blows. Then, as if someone had thrown open a door to fierce winter, darkness swept over the chamber, and the cavern suddenly seemed to plunge into a terrible cold. But what Vieki could feel through Atuku's thoughts was a thousand times worse. Beyond the cavern in which they stood, beyond their sacred mountain, beyond life itself, he could sense a lurking chill, so deep and so cold, that nothing alive could approach it. Only Queen Atuku, armored in the song of Akanabe's minions and wielding the thoughts of her subjects like a weapon, dared to match herself against that ultimate, life-swallowing darkness. Vieki could feel his own heart beating so fast he thought it must burst from the terror of that ultimate shadow, but at the same instant it seemed to be happening impossibly far away. He felt like a single bubble among thousands in one of Nakiga's frothing hot lakes. Now Moyere's granddaughter began to writhe against her bonds, head back and mouth agape as though she were drowning. It was hard for Vieki to see through the deepening gloom. Even the ochre light of the well seemed to be shrinking, dying. But as the song gained strength, the young woman's movements atop the litter became more rapid and erratic, until her head was whipping violently from side to side. Marshal Moyere let out a loud groan, and even seemed as if he might go to her. But one of his sacrificed generals put a hand on his shoulder. The marshal grew still again, face stolid. But Vieki could tell that beneath the stony presence, Moyere was as desperate as a trapped animal. The light of the well had faded until it seemed as dim as the glow of a distant dying star. Yajilamu's blind eyes turned helplessly toward the watchers, and her mouth opened in a shriek of pain that never broke free. Caught up in the song and helpless, Vieki thought he saw his own daughter Nezeru there, calling to him for help that he could not give.
"That is the other purpose of this," he realized in despair. "Not just to bring back Omu, but so Akenabi can show us that only he has the Queen's favor, that he alone now decides who lives and dies. Moyere's granddaughter, my child, no matter how powerful the noble or the clan, the Lord of Song wants it known that he can reach out to take whoever he chooses, and the Queen will support him."
Vieki looked to Atuku, who watched the girl's suffering without any sign of pity, and he felt something break inside him, something that had been there all his life, a belief, a trust.
"That could be my own daughter,"
was all he could think. Over and over,
"it could be Nezeru."
Yajalamu was thrashing harder now atop the litter. For a moment it seemed the force of her agonized struggle might break the heavy bonds that held her. Then her bones began to glow. First the skull bloomed behind the girl's face, a hot light that made her pale skin glow like the oiled parchment of a lantern. Next, her grasping hands became things of fierce radiance, and smoke began to rise from garments torn and disarranged by her struggles. Within moments, her clothing curled and darkened, becoming smoke and ash, even as it lay against her ivory skin. until the marshal's granddaughter was all but naked. Legs and arms wreathed in flame, all her secrets exposed to the staring multitude. Then Yar Jalamu's flesh itself caught fire. It licked upward even from her mouth and nostrils and the corners of her eyes. Then, in an instant, all her skin blazed into light. She threw her head back, and steam gushed from her sagging mouth. Shivers of burning red climbed out of her throat to splash flame in all directions over the litter. But the conveyance was made of ancient, cured witchwood, and mere fire would not harm it. Only the girl burned. It was all Vieki could do to keep his knees locked, to remain upright. He felt as though he were ablaze, too. But instead of his flesh, it was his thoughts, his certainties, that were burning away into ash. Very soon there was nothing to be seen of Yar Jalamu, but a faint movement in the depths of the fire, a flutter of ash, a pair of black sticks waving. The heat was so intense that the air shimmered and grew untrustworthy. But Vieki still had not felt it, and the singers crouched around the litter seemed not to feel it either. A few paces from the heart of the blaze, Queen Atuku stared down on the spectacle from behind her featureless mask. Vieki could no more guess at her thought than he could have supposed the desires of a distant star. But a part of his own thought still resonated with the queen's, and as he stared at her, he felt something come through from the dark reaches beyond the world he knew. Something from that lifeless place was forcing its way out of the cold and blackness, into the world of the living. As the flames began to die down, the center of the blaze was visible once more, but instead of the blackened wreckage Vieki expected to see there, a scatter of cindered bones, something else sat in the queen's litter, something whole and strange, a figure of shifting red light, wreathed in smoke.
"Amukri!" cried Akanabi. "Amu the Whisperer, you have again returned to us from death. May your wisdom and strength help preserve your people, the people you twice gave your life to protect."
As the queen's grip on his thoughts loosened, Vieki slowly collapsed to his knees in exhausted terror, as many others around him had already done. He could not look at the shape in the litter directly. It was too strange, too angular, and seemed both far away and terrifyingly close at the same time, as though it had not entirely emerged into his own world of length and distance. Only when Akanabi and his singers rose and surrounded the shape did Vieki realize that he had been holding his breath for so long he was nearly faint. He let it out with a ragged sigh. Some of his fellow nobles had fallen insensible to the cavern floor. Others had prostrated themselves, amazed and full of veneration, to see their queen cheat death itself, and exhilarated by the small part they had played in it. Then, just when even the lightless ones had fallen silent, and it seemed that the ritual had ended, the shape in the litter suddenly began to thrash in a wild but silent spasm of movement and red light. Vieki could feel it, though. A quivering touch on the membrane that separated the chamber of the harp from the regions beyond life. A violence against its tension, as though a doomed fly struggled against a web. And Vieki himself was one strand of that web. Mist swirled, obscuring the litter and its occupant. He was surprised. Could it be that Yar Jalamu somehow still fought for the body Akanabi stole from her? Brave heart, brave woman. A few heartbeats later, though, he thought he could feel something much different, something powerful that was trying to follow Omu out into the living world, an old and angry thing, full of hate. His heart sped ever faster, until he feared it might burst. The light of the well flared for a moment, bright as an earthbound sun, then dimmed as a great soundless cry of anguish made the assembled nobles grab at their heads in pain and horror. At the same moment, a palpable sense of something ending swept through the chamber, as though all the strands of the web of thought that connected them had snapped at once. It was clear that the way that they had opened into outer darkness had just closed again.
Amo. Amo. Shishimweka.
The queen had not spoken for some time, and these sudden words boomed in Vieki's head like a blacksmith pounding at an anvil, their gloating strength bringing tears to his eyes again.
She has come back, the Whisperer. Praise her. Yes, praise her, cried Akenabi. With Amu's help, our great queen will be able to avenge all that has been done to us. We will burn the mortals from the face of the land. We will claim the Witchwood crown.
The glow of the well abruptly faded to its ordinary brightness. Akenabi's minions wrapped the glowing thing in lengths of white cloth, wrapping it round and round as though it were just another corpse being prepared to wait for the garden's return. But this thing lived, though its movements seemed those of an infant, the twitching of something that had not yet mastered its own limbs. The flames were gone, but the shape itself still glowed, so that the singers of Akenabi's order seemed to be swaddling a molten stone. After a time they finished their work and stepped back from the litter. Though the figure that swayed there was wrapped head to foot in bandages, ruby light leaked between the wrappings each time it moved. Akenabi stepped up and draped a ceremonial singer's robe across the figure's shoulders, then tugged the hood forward to hide the faceless head, so that nearly all the glow was hidden. Those nobles who had not lost their wits and fallen senseless to the ground watched, listless and stupefied, but their expressions seemed almost ashamed. The queen's guards now lifted the litter and carried it and its shrouded passenger toward the arched doorway. The rest of the white-helmeted teeth stepped forward from behind the throne and began to drive the confused and largely unspeaking elite of Nakiga back across the cavern toward the stairs. It was not entirely clear what had transpired here in the chamber of the well, but Vieki sensed that all of them had been made part of some grave bargain whose end remained unknown.
What truly happened? He wondered. Do we face such a terrible threat that a horror such as this, the murder of an innocent, was our only choice? Then why have we not begun to prepare against another siege?
Full of such dubious, almost certainly treasonous thoughts, he did not notice Jijibo the dreamer approaching until the queen's odd descendant reached out and took his arm. Exhausted and anxious, Vieki recoiled.
Congratulations, said Jijibo, grinning. Yeah, hey, but just look at him. He's been thinking too much, and now it's made him ill.
It took the bewildered Vieki a moment to realize Jijibo was talking in his bizarre way about Vieki himself.
What do you mean, congratulations?
He asked.
He really doesn't know, said
Jijibo, wriggling with pleasure.
Your family has been noticed, Magister Vieki. Yes, your family has been noticed in some very high places.
Vieki had no idea what the queen's strange relative meant, but the words still chilled him.
I'm afraid I don't understand. No. You don't, do you? Not yet. But then again, it is not always good to be noticed, is it? After all, look at that one.
Jijibu pointed to something beyond Vieki, then turned and trotted away up the stairs, laughing and talking to himself. Confused, Vieki looked back and saw Marshal Moyere being led out of the chamber of the well by his officers, some consoling him over his loss, others congratulating him on the singular honor he had been given. The High Marshal did not look at any of them, but stared ahead helplessly, as lost and baffled as if he had been struck by lightning. 11. The Third Duke. People had dressed warmly, and the great chapel of St. Helvard's Cathedral smelled of furs and grease and torch smoke. Miriamel had thought she was impervious to the reek of many people pressed together, but she was feeling dizzy. Froda, the escritor of Elvritzhala, was ancient and not particularly swift of foot. As he ascended to the pulpit, the queen found herself wanting to help push him up the stairs, but reminded herself that patience with others, especially the old and infirm, was one of the virtues the Aidan had most emphatically preached. When he reached his spot, the escritor took a pair of lenses in a frame from his gold vestments and perched them on the bridge of his long, thin nose. "Morghenis used to have something just like that," Simon whispered to her. "It's called a spectacle." Froda looked out over the gathering, which, in addition to the visitors from the south, comprised several hundred of Rimmersgaard's most important people, and cleared his throat. To Miriamel it felt like the trumpet of an invading army. She had never liked funerals, and she liked them even less at her age, when they were no longer rare occurrences.
"Long ago,"
the escritor began, his voice reedy but surprisingly strong,
"these lands were a wilderness, a place where darkness of all kinds ruled. Before we came to Rimmersgaard, our people lived across the ocean in Isgard, a green land in the west, and although they prospered there, they did not thank God for their fortune, but worshipped instead the pagan demons of their fathers. Because of their heedlessness, the Lord sent a great catastrophe. The greatest mountain of that land burst into flames and fell down upon their chiefest cities, and all the skies went dark. Then Elvrid, far-seeing, led his people in their many ships through that darkness and across the ocean to this land, and thus were his people saved. And he built in these lands a great kingdom for himself, and his children ruled after him. The mightiest of those was Fingil, and during his life he ruled from the Himmelfells south to the Glen Iwent, and was called Fingil the Great."
"Fingil the Great," Miriamel thought. "Or as the people called him who had lived here before the Northmen came, Fingil the Bloody-Handed. What does any of this nonsense have to do with dear Isgrimnor?" She looked sadly at their old friend's coffin, draped in the banners of his house, and of Elvritzhala, with the ducal crown perched atop them all.
"But Elvrit's people brought their old gods into this new land," the escritor went on, "and still did not heed the words of our Lord, the true God. So the Lord sent unto them a punishment. The great dragon who came into the Hayholt and destroyed King Ikferdig, Fingal's successor, driving our people back into the northernmost lands, home of Norns and giants and other grim enemies. And although Aidenite priests, like our St. Helvard, tried to save our people from the Lord's wrath by leading them to the true faith, it was King John of Erkinland, the mighty Prester John, who slew the great dragon and finally brought the Lord God to his proper seat in Rimmersgaard. Later, John Ford, the last king of Rimmersgaard, Jormgrun Redhand, who carried the relics and token of the old gods into battle, and at Narved, Prester John defeated him. And then John, in his wisdom, chose that good man Ispeon from all the other nobles to rule the people of this new conquered land. But only if Ispeon would cast away his false gods and accept the true God, who sent his son, Osiris, to die, that man might live forever. Duke Ispeon did embrace the true God, praise the highest, and afterward ruled long and well. His son Iskrimnor ruled even longer than his father had, granted a long life by the god he served so faithfully. And today, it is that life we celebrate. Our beloved Duke Iskrimnor fought the Lord's battles up and down the length of Ostenard. He battled the barbarians of the Thrythings, and the terrible Storm King at the very gates of the Hayholt, John's capital, helping to save it and the Aedonite people, perhaps all people, from destruction. And then Iskrimnor pursued the Norns, all the way to their foul seat in the Nornfells, driving them into hiding with so much loss that they have not troubled mankind again. Now, our beloved Duke is with the Lord once more. Now he sits at the right hand of a master, even greater than King John Presbyter. But he has not left us unguarded. His son Grimbrand will take up the Sea Rover's crown and rule over all the lands of Rimmersgard under John's high ward, in the name of John's heirs, King Siomen and Queen Miriamel. Two dukes Rimmersgard has been given under God's leadership. And now, a third to come, another godly man, and peace has prevailed.
Here the escritor paused to remove his lenses and polish them on his stole. Miriamel felt a tickle of hope that the long afternoon might be coming to an end, at least the part that took place in the smoky, draughty cathedral. As far as she was concerned, it could not end too soon. The days since the Duke's passing had been filled with every kind of obligation. She had met so many northern nobles, she could no longer remember what Grimbrand had told her about a single one of them.
But let us remember that God's favor is only granted to the righteous,
Escrator Froda resumed in a ringing voice.
As Grimbrand follows his father and grandfather as the third Duke of Elvritsala, let us remember that we must all follow him in the ways of the Lord. For only by God's hand can our people survive and prosper.
To the Queen's relief, he then led the congregation in the final prayers of the Mansa Seja Quilosan. She reached out for Simon, wanting to feel her husband's warm, real presence. He jumped a little, perhaps startled to be reminded of what was going on around him, but after a moment folded his large hand around hers.
It's bloody strange, if you ask me, Simon said as they followed the Duke's effigy out to the dock.
In the old days, the Rimmersmen used to burn all their dead, she explained.
Yes, and in the old days, the Rimmersmen used to kill Erkinlanders as well, not to mention Scythi and everyone else.
Shh, do you want Grimbrand to hear you?
The Duke's heir walked only a few yards behind them with his wife and children. Behind them came Iskrimnor's daughters, Signy and Ismay, and their husbands, Valfrid and Tongerd of Skogi. Signy was a grandmother herself now, Miri realized. She was overwhelmed once more by the realization of how the years had spun on so swiftly since they had last visited, since Signy had been a pink-cheeked bride and Grimbrand a youth with his first beard. But it had been a long time since anyone had thought him a youth. He had waited long, patient years to take his father's place. Grimbrand was a good man, and she felt sure Rimmersgard was in trustworthy hands. But it still felt strange beyond understanding to be following the great straw funeral effigy of Elvrit's ship Sortfengsel, and to know that their friend Iskrimnor was truly gone.
How did it come to be that we are the old ones now, Simon?
Same way it always does.
The sun was coming out now after a grey morning full of snow flurries, snow that had now all turned to puddles of water. Her husband squinted.
People tell you what to do. You do your best, but you don't always succeed. Then one day, you realize that you're the one doing the telling.
Yes, but nobody is listening. Look at Grimbrand's son, Isfar. See how respectful he is? But where is our grandson? I have not seen him since the cathedral, slouching.